evening, everyone. I'm very sorry for the delay in starting this evening. It's great to have you with us. I'm Simon Jones. I'm the interim dean of Lincoln. I'm the interim dean because I'm here on a 9 month secondment from Merton College, Oxford, where I've been the chaplain for about 20 years. I arrived at Lincoln at the end of March, and my expiry date is Christmas Day, so I go back to Oxford after Evensong on Christmas Day. It's a very great pleasure on behalf of the chapter at Lincoln to welcome you to this eighth and final lecture in the Lincoln Cathedral series. As some of you will know, within this series of talks, we're asking, how can common good theology help us play our part in spiritual and civic renewal? And we really appreciate the partnership we have with Together for the Common Good. It's part of our wider Lincoln Cathedral Common Good project, helping us to develop our civic and social engagement. One of the things I've been involved with over the past 8 months is helping the cathedral to think about its strategy for the next phase of our life. And one of the strands within that strategy is deepening our engagement with the wider community. And so this series of lectures has been enormously helpful in providing a theological framework to help us to do that. Jenny, over to you.
Thank you, Simon. So yes, we're Together for the Common Good, delighting to be partnering with you to put this series on for Lincoln Cathedral. And in fact, these talks are for everyone to help us reflect how God calls us out of the deep malaise in which we find ourselves towards spiritual and civic renewal. Whether it's about human freedom, the economy, work, people and planet, civic and political life, or social peace, all these areas need our attention in this time of profound change. Recordings are online at togetherforthecommongood.co.uk. So we're featuring speakers from different traditions who draw on Catholic social teaching to explore how Christian theology can be a blessing on public life. And tonight we're going to hear from Sister Helen Alford, who is uniquely equipped to help us explore questions around how we live together. Sister Helen has come over especially from Rome, especially for this, and we'll be giving the lecture before a small invited audience here. It's really an honour to have Sister Helen with us, and we're excited to hear what she has to say. Before we get started, I'd just like to thank CCLA for hosting this evening, our longtime partner and amazing supportive friend of Together for the Common Good. CCLA is the UK's leading sustainability fund manager for charities, faith and public sector organisations with a long history of managing assets for Christian organisations. And within that, they have an investment fund specifically aligned with Catholic social teaching, suitable for Catholic charities, churches, dioceses, schools and religious orders. And they've also launched a Better World Faith Consistent Fund for individual investors, and they provide the secretariat for the Church Investors Group, helping Christian investors generate faith-aligned investment policies with, for example, modern-day slavery, cost of living crisis, mental health, and climate change. So we'll be taking questions later. So if you're watching on Zoom, please use the Q&A function, or if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, do enter questions in the chat. Over to you, Simon.
Thanks very much, Jenny. So I'm delighted now to introduce Sister Helen Alford. Sister Helen is President of the Pontifical Academy for Social Sciences and Dean of the Faculty for Social Sciences at the Angelicum, Rome's Pontifical University. An economist, she teaches economic ethics, the history of technology, labour politics and Catholic social thought. Sister Helen is from England, lives in Rome, and is a sister of the Dominican Sisters of St. Catherine of Siena of Newcastle, Natal. This increasingly fragmented and divided culture, we're enormously grateful to Sister Helen for her help in navigating these present confusions. Drawing on her expertise in Catholic social thought, Sister Helen will address the causes of division and examine the possibilities for social peace. We look forward very much to hearing what the Spirit of God might be saying in this time of great upheaval and to exploring how the church might be called to act. Sister Helen, it's wonderful to have you with us. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Dean, Simon. Thank you, Jenny. Thank you to all the team. Thank you to all the people who are here with me in the room now. And also thanks to all of you online. It's really a great honor and privilege for me to be able to share some thoughts with you and to have a discussion with you about this very important topic. Now, I would like to start on a short personal note, because I sat down to start writing this talk the day after I heard that Lachlan Hickey had died, who many of you here in this room and maybe people online too also had the pleasure of knowing. I want to give this talk in his honour, partly because I was unable to do the kind of thinking that we need, I think, to work through with Catholic social teaching in conversation with him. And I think he's really one of the most interesting thinkers I've ever had the good fortune or the providential guidance to meet. So I'd like this talk to start with him in mind. So Jenny asked me to talk under the title Just Peace, on social peace and the causes of division. Now, in some ways, this is a new problem. You know, as I was thinking about writing this, I was thinking, would someone like Jenny have asked someone like me to give a talk on social peace 25 years ago? I'm not sure if we would have thought this was an important topic at that point. So in that sense, it's kind of an emerging issue for us in our stage of history. Now, we know that we have new things which are causing division amongst our members of our society. We know from our personal experience, from newspaper stories, research, that social media, for instance, is an important source of division in our society today. So that's something new. We have a new combination of ideas, theories, philosophies, which are creating new problems for us. And I would say, let's put on the table too, the question of faith or belief, which connects us with trust as well. As you probably know, in many languages, it's the same word for faith and for trust, which the changes on that level are in some ways unprecedented as well. So there's a whole lot of new issues causing new division. And that means that the solutions that we found for social peace in the past can no longer be applied, or at least not applied in the same way as they were in the past. At the same time, of course, and you're expecting me to say this, living in peace with each other is a perennial problem. You know, the second sin recorded in the book of Genesis, after the primordial one of breaking our relationship with God, is a sin against peace, the killing of a brother. Now, I've no doubt that those of other religious traditions who may be here tonight or online could also recount similar stories from the foundational texts of their religious traditions. And we know that Greek, Roman, Viking, and other mythical systems are full of stories of violence and destruction. Even if, as Joseph Campbell, in his idea of the hero's journey, talking especially about myths, would argue that confronting the destructiveness in many of these mythical stories is a source of heroism and part of arriving at the good, such as the peace of the Shire at the end of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. So these foundational myths, part of our perennial experience, represent a source for us, a resource for us, in dealing with our search for social peace. Now, I'm not going to talk about these myths from now on, but if you wanted to bring them up in the discussion, I would be very happy about that, because I think the storytelling issue is very important for our problems today, and also the arts in general, whether they be visual, auditory, talking about music, of course, or something like culinary arts. We think about food and the way in which that's a crucial element of peace building, or any other kind of poesis, if we can use that Greek word, the making of something good and beautiful in itself, which of course is very closely connected to praxis, another Greek idea, the idea of making ourselves and our society good and virtuous and beautiful and, yes, peaceful. So in this face of these two things, new problems and perennial issues, I want to be like the householder that Christ talks about in the Gospel of Matthew, who brings out of his treasure, out of his house, a treasure that is new and old. Put these things together. Try to find interesting, innovative solutions by drawing on ancient texts or classic texts in dialogue with new problems. So, to do this, I want to use what is probably the most classic source on peace in the Catholic social tradition, Pacem in Terris, which is 60 years old this year, so it's also a significant year to look back at it, and look at it in relation to two key problems that I think are causing division, and maybe this text could help us in constructing social peace in the face of these two key causes of division. The first one is our relation with the environment. What does building peace with the natural world mean? And how can we do it when there's so much tension between ourselves about it? This may well come up more, in more detail in the discussion. Then there's another set of problems to do with respect for rights and the question of peace. You know, the whole rights area is such a contested domain now, with all kinds of things being called rights, and with the whole discourse about them, I think for many of us being much more connected with aggression and terms like culture wars and things like this, rather than with peace. So I think we can look in Pacem in Terris for some kind of word about these two kinds of problems. Then I would like to connect what Pacem in Terris is saying with another text which comes from the same historical period, which I think you might find surprising, this connection, and of course that's why I'm doing it. It will be illuminating in another way. And then finally we'll conclude. So let's start with Pacem in Terris. Now the first thing I'm going to say to you is that the key term that Pope John uses in his encyclical about peace is the term order. Order is it's like if you think of a piece of Blackpool rock, if Pacem in Terris was a piece of Blackpool rock, the word order would be going all the way through it from one end to the other. Now, before going on and saying anything else, I just want to stop and ask the people who are here in the room, and then I'll repeat so you can hear on the mic, people who are online, what they say. Ask the people in the room, when you hear the word order, what does it make you think of? You know, what's a semantic field for you around order? If you could just say the words out loud and I'll repeat them. It would be very interesting for me to hear. What do you think of when you hear the word order?
Tidiness.
Structure.
Law and order.
Systematic, law and order, great.
Control,
okay. Anything else?
Natural,
ooh, interesting.
Chaos.
There was another word I didn't hear.
Safety.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for sharing some of this semantic field. So we can see there's different terms, you know, associated with order. So I might want to say to you, probably not all of you, but at least some of you, that you might want to suspend a little bit your normal semantic field around this word to open yourself to what the Pope is going to be saying to you in this document. Because I think the number one thing, if you forget everything else about this talk, don't forget this point. This is the one point really to remember. The main thing that Pope John is trying to call us to do by using that word order is to recognize the basic structure of reality. To recognize the basic structure of reality, or the key characteristics of the world we live in. Now, you might think, what has the word order really got to do with the basic structure of reality? And in order to answer that question, why is the Pope using it, you need to know something about his background and his formation. So I would say there's a general point to make on this, and then there's a more specific point. So the general point is that Pope John, like all Catholic priests before the Vatican Council, was formed within the manual traditions, and all these manuals were full of quotes and bits of St. Thomas Aquinas's thinking. You know, modern Thomists would say it was a distorted kind of Thomism they got, but nevertheless, they certainly got a lot of concepts and ideas out of Thomists, of St. Thomas's thought. And order is one of them. Order is a very, very important term for St. Thomas. But there's also a more specific background that we can get from the diaries of Pope John himself. In the Second World War, in 1942, he was the apostolic delegate, so the representative of the Pope, to Turkey and Greece. That was his job. He was in Istanbul. And he started a retreat on the Feast of Christ the King. For those of us Catholic, we had that yesterday, that feast. He started a retreat on the Feast of Christ the King in 1942. The retreat giver was giving him a talk about the image of the perfect bishop using texts from Isidore of Seville. And so on the night of the first day of the retreat, he wrote in his diary, "The bishop must be distinguished by his own understanding and his adequate explanation to others of the philosophy of history." This is very important to remember, the philosophy of history. "Even the history that is now before our eyes, adding pages of blood to pages of political and social disorders," middle of the Second World War. "I want to reread St. Augustine's City of God and draw from his doctrine the necessary material to form my own judgment." So he goes to read the City of God, and any of you who know anything about St. Augustine's City of God will know the key idea that he has connected with peace is the idea in Latin of tranquillitas ordinis, the tranquility of order. So when you can understand when 20 years later Pope John sits down to write this encyclical on peace, this is also in his back of his mind, what he read from St. Augustine, which he wanted to make his own. As he said, he had to have his own idea about the philosophy of history. Now, if you thought maybe, well, this idea order isn't necessarily the best idea to use if we want to talk about the basic structure of reality, as I said, you wouldn't be alone in thinking that, and you certainly wouldn't be alone amongst other members of the Catholic Church. So I just want to mention one example of the kind of critique that this idea got, which comes from a text written not that much later, only 10 years after the publication of Parchmenteris, and written by a very influential figure in the Catholic Church, Cardinal, I don't know if we say Roy or Roy, because he's from Quebec, so probably we should say Roy. He was the president of the Pontifical Council of Justice and Peace at the time. And in commemoration of Parchmenteris on the 10th anniversary, he wrote a public letter to the Pope, Paul VI at that time, on the 10th anniversary of Parchmenteris. So looking at the text again, 10 years on. So we're now in 1973. And he doesn't say very complimentary things about the use of the idea order in the text of Parchmenteris. I quote, "This word," so order, "this word jars the modern mentality, as does even more the idea that it summons up," so the semantic field around order, "a sort of complicated organic scheme or gigantic genealogical tree in which each being and group has its predetermined place." Everybody knows where they are and it's fixed. And then he goes on to say, "It would be much better if we used other words," and he gives a whole series of other terms. And the last one is the concept of values, he says, which is very much used today. In other words, we should really be using more modern terminology. Now, I don't want to make a judgment about Cardinal Roy. Maybe in 1973 there was very good reason for saying that. But I think in 2023, in the different circumstances that we are now, a recovery of the idea of order as presented in Parchmenteris could be very useful for us in dealing especially with those two problems I mentioned at the beginning. So, as I said, the idea of order runs through Parchmenteris from beginning to end. The very first phrase I just read to you, "Peace on earth, which man throughout the ages has so longed for and sought after, can never be established, never guaranteed, except by the diligent observance of the divinely established order. Okay, so that's a pretty strong statement. If we really want peace, we have to go back to this order. And in fact, you can see that there's six levels of order that he talks about in the encyclical. You might be surprised where he starts. The first level is order in the universe. He starts with the universe, which I think is very interesting given our environmental problems today. We'll come back to that later. So first level is order in the universe. Then we get order within human beings. Third level is order between human beings. Fourth level is order between human beings and their political authority. So it's order in the political community. The fifth level of order is the order between states or between political communities. And then the last, sixth level, is the order on the worldwide community. Now, we're not going to say much about the top levels of the order. We're going to mostly focus on the first three or four levels in our talk, but it's interesting to see how he uses it at all these different levels. Now, before looking at those early stages, I want to say one general point, which actually also comes from the encyclical, because the Pope says in the course of his document that order in the world can be described partly in scientific terms, but also refers to the overall goals of human beings and their relationships, and that means we need to use philosophy and theology as well. So we need science, philosophy, theology to talk about order in its complete sense. Now, I would say only one point about this, that some of the things that in the 1960s, when this document was written, that could only be described using philosophy can now be described at least partially using scientific results. And that's very interesting, I think, for us. For instance, one of the things the Pope will say is that we are naturally social beings. You know, and we could just imagine the average economist in 1960 thinking, well, that's just an old priest coming out with that stuff. Absolutely not. We have our individual preferences. We're just all competing with each other. It's the individual that's important. This social relational stuff is, you know, namby-pamby kind of stuff, you know, just for people who don't know what they're talking about. Now we've got all kinds of scientific results which actually show more and more that that's the case. Perhaps the most impressive research source for this is the happiness research, because that is done all around the world, so we can look at below the level of culture what is common to human beings across all the different cultural differences using the happiness research. And what we find is that at low levels of income, if you increase income, you increase happiness. So you could say, well, that could be compatible with an individual idea because, you know, I get more money, I can buy more things, I can achieve more of my individual objectives, and I feel more happy. So the two things go together. But at a fairly low level, the two things start diverging. And you can carry on increasing income and happiness doesn't increase at the same rate. Instead, it's much more correlated with another factor, which is the quality of relationships. So this is a really interesting scientific result, which converges with the philosophical result. We can also get similar results coming out of genetics or out of game theory, for instance. There are lots of different sources for now showing that we are very socially oriented beings. And if what we're talking about, remember that first phrase I said, forget everything else, but remember the first phrase. If we're really talking about the basic structure of reality, and there's an honest search for this on the part of scientists, philosophers, and theologians, then we should expect that they could converge. And if science can develop more and enter more into the domain that we thought was only philosophical and theological before and give insight into that, it'll be no surprise that we see some convergence, because all of these thinkers and all of these scientists are engaged in an honest search for truth. They're trying to understand the basic structure of reality. So, with that said, let's look at the first stage in Pope John's use of the idea of order. As we said, it's order in the universe he starts with. Now, my guess is that this idea would have been less striking to an audience in the 1960s than it is to us now, which may explain why this part of the text is very short. It's only a few sentences, a couple of paragraphs. Nevertheless, what he's written here is quite striking. And although his way of writing is different from Pope Francis's, the content, I think, could have been written by Pope Francis, but he would do it in a different way. So let me just quote from this second paragraph of the text. He says, "That a marvelous order predominates in the world of living beings and in the forces of nature is the plain lesson which the progress of modern research and the discoveries of technology teach us." And then he goes on, "And it is part of the greatness of man that he can appreciate that order." Appreciate that order. He's not creating it. He's receiving it as a gift. He can learn from it. He can work with it. He can try to understand it. And then he said, devise means for harnessing the forces in nature. And that's, of course, our environmental crisis tells us that we don't always do that very well. But nevertheless, we have the capacity to do that. So he doesn't say any more about order in the universe. He's a very short statement about that. Then he moves to the second level, which is order within human beings, arguing there that human beings participate in the order of the universe, and they also have a special role in maintaining it. He says, God created man in his own image and likeness, endowed him with intelligence and freedom. That's very important, the endowment. Endowed him with intelligence and freedom. We'll come back to this later. And then made him Lord of creation. Well, again, in the 1960s, you might think, scientists would think, well, that's all just religious namby-pamby stuff. But when we think now about this idea of the Anthropocene, you know, the huge impact that we are having on our planet and the capacity we have to sort of change its structure, and often in a negative way, maybe this idea of being the Lord of creation, maybe not with those words, it's not so out of our possible mindset to think like that. But he doesn't dwell very long on this point. He immediately notes that between us there is disunity, which he says is striking, in striking contrast to the perfect order in the universe. So although he's saying there's order in us, he immediately also brings in the problem of disunity, which isn't ordered. We'd say it's disordered in that sense. He says, our relations only seem to be governable by force, he says. And yet there is a kind of order within us, which he puts in this way. The world's creator has stamped man's inmost being with an order. And how could it be otherwise, he says. All created being reflects the infinite wisdom of God. It reflects it all the more clearly the higher it stands in the scale of perfection. So he wants to say, as classic thinking would say, that human beings are higher up than non-living or other living beings because of this intelligence and freedom that we have, because that we can use our knowledge to do things for the good. Still, we have this problem now, disunity and order, side by side, coexisting. What to make of it? Well, in the next paragraph, the Pope argues that we can have mistaken ideas of this order. So this is one of the sources of the disunity. He says, many people think that the laws which govern man's relations are the same as those which regulate the blind elemental forces of the universe. But it is not so. The laws which govern men, sorry, I'm just, perhaps I should say people, but it's in the text, so I just carry on. The laws which govern men are quite different, he says. And that made me think, when I read that phrase, about the very strong impact on economic thinking. As you know, I deal mostly with economics, of physical systems. You know, when the early economists are developing their models, Newton is seen as a sort of enlightenment figure. He's brought light into the world with his ideas about physics. And so all the economists want to have set up systems which are like the physical systems. So it's these kinds of blind elemental forces that get transferred into our thinking about economics. But he says that's not so. The laws which govern us are different. He says the Father of the universe has inscribed these laws into man's nature, and that is where we must look for them. So this is where we're going to come to another crucial point, which is the point that I'm going to find the most difficult to deal with you. So I hope you will have some patience with me. And this is the question of natural law, because I'm going to have to make a slight divergence from the text and say something about natural law. The trouble is, we really should have a whole talk just about natural law to do it properly. So I'm going to make a risky attempt to try to say something useful just in a paragraph. So I hope you will have mercy on me. Okay, so the basic idea of natural law is pretty simple. The idea that we are oriented to do what is good for us through our nature. So if we look at other animals, we could say they are oriented to do what is good for them and for their species also, but they function more in terms of instinct. Whereas we are able to think and reason about what we choose to do, and we can choose between different goods. So if I have 2 hours a week to spend on doing something interesting, I could learn Polish or do acrobatics or visit a housebound person or whatever I think is the good thing to do in the context of my life. Now, I've already started to mention the first practical principle of natural law thinking: do good and avoid evil. Now, we can think about this on two levels. Okay, the first or primary level regards human beings as they were made to be. We could say human beings before the fall, as they truly could be. Now, it's interesting that our understanding of good on this level really is accessible to all. It's really, we could say, inscribed in our nature. You know, it's things like world peace. I mean, we just know we'd all be better off if we had world peace. You know, it's being kind to each other. I mean, we just know. You don't need to explain it. It's just obvious to us that these are good things to do. So this is our participation in the natural law that the Pope is talking about. We just know this stuff. You don't have to have a PhD in something or other to know this stuff. Everybody can know it. If you have the PhD, sometimes you're a bit more confused about it. You know what I say? So that is the sort of first level of natural law. But since we know we're not actually without sin, or we're not fully developed, these kinds of ideas of good often seem utopian. But they could also be seen as a goal that we're trying to achieve if society could gradually move in this direction. They remain a kind of a goal, not really achievable goal, but something to which we can try to tend. They can inspire us. Okay. Then there's the secondary level of natural law, which is one that relates to the historical experience of being human, which is full of disunity, as we said. It's full of sin, it's full of weakness, it's full of all the problems we know. It depends on historical circumstances, cultural traditions, and all this kind of thing. Now, at this kind of level, it's much more difficult to work out what is the good thing to do. It depends on all kinds of things. You know? So if we think about economics, you know, the church would say, or natural law tradition would say, at the first level, we should have an economy that includes everybody. It should be for everybody, the economy, and it should have a sustainable relationship with our environment. You know, that's obvious. We all could understand. If you went out on the street and asked people, maybe not in the City of London, because they're a bit funny, the people in the City of London, but anywhere else in the world, ask the beggars or the tourists or the shopkeepers, if you could have a perfect economy, what would it be like? They'd say all kinds of things, but you bet the most often said things would be those two things. Everybody should be part. And that's the sort of thinking on the first level of natural law. But, of course, that's not where we are. You know, we can't just, in a communist system, have everything for everybody. It doesn't work because we're weak, we're sinful, we're not there. So the church would say, okay, we need private property. That's important. We know from historical reasons, if we don't have private property, we won't achieve the goods and make the effort to produce goods that we do actually do when we have that. But it's always for the first level. So the idea of distribution, involvement, and that stays there. Or people sometimes say private property has a social mortgage when they say the way the church thinks about private property. So that's the first thing about natural law. It has these two levels. Okay, it's about achieving the good and at these two levels. The second quick point I want to say is that it also involves natural law thinking, taking seriously the idea of inclinations. You know, we said animals have instincts. Okay, we also have something like that, which we can call inclinations. So, for instance, if I'm feeling hungry, that inclines me to eat. Okay, now, in general, that's a good thing. You know, but I might sometimes not want to eat for some very good reason. You know, I need to lose weight or something. And also this, the way we deal with that inclination can become disordered, you know, too much or too little, you know, this kind of thing. We also have inclination to learn things. We have intellectual curiosity. Now, that usually helps us do good things as well. We learn new things, we get new knowledge, but again, it can be misused, and this is leading us towards a corollary body of thought about virtues, which any of you who know about natural law thinking will know a lot about. Now, that's a very short, brief sort of synthesis of some of the key things in natural law. We could say a lot more about it, but I hope these few words give you the sense that in this way of thinking, the kind of beings we are show us how we should behave. And that's how we can participate in the order of the universe that the Pope is talking about. Now, this seems to me, and I'm going to finish here, dealing with the first point about the environment. This seems to me very important in a world that has learned that it needs to deal with the nature around it according to the way that nature is. And not just as if we don't have to consider it. We can put as much pollution into it as we want, or just however we want to think about that. We have to treat the nature around us according to the way it is. So the Pope in Parchemin Terris connects that realization to the idea that in a similar way, we can only have peace among ourselves if we respect the way we are, or as he puts it here, the law inscribed in our hearts, the kinds of beings we are too. So he puts those two things side by side. And I think that could be interesting. We could have an interesting discussion about that. So now I'm going to move to the second point, the relation between rights and order. Now, at the third level of order, when he's talking about the relation between human beings, Pope John focuses on the recognition of what he calls one key principle. And this is what he says, a principle of this order, that each individual person is truly, or each individual man is truly a person. Whoops. Anyway, his is a nature that is endowed with intelligence and free will. Again, we get this idea of being endowed again. Intelligence and free will. As such, he has rights and duties, which together flow as a direct consequence from his nature. These rights and duties are universal, inviolable, and therefore also inalienable. Now, then he goes on to discuss some of these rights. I think there's about 25. It's a little bit difficult to know because sometimes he repeats the same right in different ways and you're not quite sure if he's trying to say something different. But it's about 25 rights that he lists, and he backs them up with quotations from St. Paul, early church thinkers, Aquinas, and recent popes. So you can see he's trying to say this rights language is absolutely solidly in the Christian tradition. He's using absolutely standard sources to back up this thinking. But then he moves on to the corresponding duties. Now, at this point, it's interesting to note that the drafters of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights also wanted to include duties in their document. That was the original plan. But since they could not get an agreement on the duties, they ended up publishing the declaration only with the rights. That was different from the original plan. Now, duties, of course, place rights within an order. Since we obviously can't have rights without, if we're in a community, without the duty to respect them. However, the parchamentarius doesn't start, when it's talking about duties, with our duty to respect the rights of others. It actually starts in a different place, with the duty we have to respect our own rights. This is what he says about this. The right to life involves the duty to preserve one's life. The right to a decent standard of living, the duty to live in a becoming fashion. The right to be free to seek out the truth, the duty to devote oneself to an ever deeper and wider search for it. So the first thing he says about duties is our duties towards our own rights. Because, of course, we've received these rights. We've been given them. We've been endowed with them. That's the word he usually uses. So this, as I say, reinforces the sense that we are endowed with rights. We are given them as a gift through our nature. And we need to respect even our own rights, even before we respect those of others. By the way, he uses natural rights and human rights more or less interchangeably. I don't see any difference in the way he uses those two terms. So the idea of rights here, through its discussion of duties, is set into a vision of order. Although it's no simple law and order discourse. For parchamentarius will also say that if laws are enacted that contradict the natural order, the just thing to do is not to keep them. And this is 51, Article 51. Laws and decrees, he says, passed in contravention of the moral order can have no binding force in conscience. Indeed, the passing of such laws undermines the very nature of authority and results in shameful abuse. As St. Thomas teaches, he says, and then he quotes from St. Thomas, we maintain that human law has the rationale of law insofar as it is in accordance with right reason. And as such, it obviously derives from eternal law. A law which is at variance with reason is to that extent unjust and has no longer the rationale of law. It is rather an act of violence. Now, I went into that in some detail because this allows me to make the third step, which is to connect parchamentarius to another document that came out 5 days after parchamentarius was published. Martin Luther King, who publishes on April the 16th, 1963, the letter from Birmingham jail, quotes exactly the same text from St. Thomas that we just read that is quoted in parchamentarius. We don't know if Martin Luther King saw parchamentarius before he wrote that letter. He was already in jail when the parchamentarius came out, so it's not very likely, but it's not impossible. But it might be even more impressive if he hadn't seen it, that he ends up in a very, very similar position, which I'll show you from reading from his text. He uses the quote from St. Thomas responding to a hypothetical question. How can you, Martin Luther King, advocate breaking some laws and keeping others? And he says the answer lies in the fact that there are two types of law, just and unjust. A just law is a man-made code that squares with the moral law, or the law of God. And then he says, to put it in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, this is actually written by his own hand in the letter, to put it in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal law and natural law. So, what do we see here? Both Pope John and Dr. King think that authentic rights claims and right order are mutually implied rather than being opposites. Keeping order should be about maintaining authentic rights, and that the ground of both these, the rights and the right order, is the nature with which we are endowed. Now, given how important Luther King is in debates about rights today, pointing out his use of the same ideas of order and natural law that we find used in Parchment Terrace in classic Catholic theology may be helpful to us in building social peace. So now I've made my three main points, I want to conclude. I would like to return to the question of faith in the crisis of today's society. In another part of his letter, Martin Luther King argues that crisis is an important moment for people to realize what is unjust in their society and to have to face that. However, an important French philosopher, theologian, Jean-Luc Marion, in his 2017 book, The Catholic Moment, argues that the problem for us in the West is not that it is in crisis, but that it is not in enough of a crisis. It is, he says, in stagnant decadence, or, he says, a crisis of crisis. And he carries on, it is precisely by the infinite deferral of the moment of crisis that the modern world defeats the gospel, since the gospel is a call to crisis that demands a decision. So, perhaps, insofar as we are no longer able to defer our crisis, we may be more open to face the wrongs of our age and more open to the need for the kind of thinking about order and natural law that Pope John proposes to us as the basis for peace. This, at least, is what we found in the economic sphere after the financial crisis, as the experience of Blueprint, in which many people here, and Lachlan, the fellow I mentioned at the beginning, was pivotal, showed clearly after the financial crisis, things changed. People started asking different questions. They started looking for new answers. So the crisis in that sense was really tough, but it did break something open, start something new. I think Ayaan Hirsi Ali's recent announcement of her adoption of Christianity is also instructive. What she talks about in her Unheard article is not so much the promise of personal salvation, although I think that's also part of it, but more that Christianity has demonstrated its capacity to build a culture that, and she says, consists of an elaborate set of ideas and institutions designed to safeguard human life, freedom, and dignity. From the nation state and the rule of law to the institutions of science, health, and learning. Now, whether others who have realized what she has realized will follow her in embracing Christianity is yet to be seen. In the meantime, it may suggest ways in which our catechetical programs could be usefully modified. At any rate, for now, the goal of this talk has been to suggest that the old idea of order in connection with that of natural law, as presented by Parchment Terrace and along the side of that Martin Luther King in the letter from Birmingham Jail, could help us in dealing with two of our new sources of division and in building social peace in our day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sister Helen. That was absolutely fantastic, a very, very rich presentation, and we're enormously grateful to you. So we're moving now to the Q&A section of proceedings. Please remember you can submit your question in the Q&A function on Zoom or on the chat on Facebook or YouTube. So while you're thinking about your questions, I wonder if I could use my prerogative as co-host to ask the first question. And that is to go back to what you've been talking about in terms of natural law, and to ask what the implications for what you've proposed are in the situation where people, even people from the same faith tradition, fundamentally disagree as to what constitutes natural law, and so how that can be to be used in that sort of context. So from my own sort of Anglican perspective, I'm thinking particularly issues around sexual ethics, but I think it could relate to a number of different areas. And therefore, sometimes in our cancel culture that we live in, any sort of dialogue between people who adopt different positions as to what might constitute natural law isn't possible.
Okay, thank you very much for this question. Well, I think my first answer would be that, or the first part of the answer would be that it would be part of natural law to recognize intelligence and freedom. We said that many times in the document. And so I think the differences between us, which may be a source of disunity but can sometimes also be an enrichment, depends what kind of difference and diversity we're talking about, we need to allow each other to be free to express our opinions about this. And that is the way where we can really learn from each other. So I think that I don't think, you know, we're always going to have problems, especially in new situations, with new technologies coming in, new kinds of relations between the different parts of the world. You know, things are changing all the time. History is changing. We're going to need to have a confrontation, dialogue, thinking, listening and learning from each other. So I think what the basic kind of natural law thing, maybe on the first level that we were talking about, would say is be open to listening to the other. You know, it's a bit like Pope Francis' culture of encounter today, something like this, that dialogue and being open is important. Dialogue, of course, means you say what you think as well. So the cancel culture thing is problematic. Because there's an interesting French philosopher called Chantal Delsol, and she talks about how we are going into a... she's pretty pessimistic about the future. She's much more pessimistic than I am. I am much more hopeful about it. She thinks that we're going into a kind of polytheistic world, which is sort of like a pre-Judeo-Christian world. And it's as if we're kind of peeling off the layer of Christianity that's been there for about 1,500 years or so and going back to the polytheistic level. But, she says, we are keeping some of the elements of Christianity in this polytheistic thing. And one of them is represented by this cancel culture. In other words, there are things that are true. There's something that we have to hold to. There's dogmas, there's beliefs, you know, that are not negotiable, you know. But as she said, that kind of thinking has been detached from its original source, which gave it life, which gave it meaning and purpose. And of course, we within Christianity now, we've learnt ways to dealing with each other that don't require kind of violent clashes of this kind. Unfortunately, these new kind of groups that are trying to use a very dogmatic position haven't really learnt that yet. They're still using very violent, very aggressive kind of techniques to get their truth, they think, kind of imposed, you know? And so I think the natural law kind of help here is that it's actually correct, and you know, I think everybody agrees with this, really, to let people say what they think. Then we can learn from each other. We're not going to learn if people are shut up and excluded because they don't hold the current position. So I think that would be most of my answer. Perhaps I need to say something else, but...
Well, we've got some more questions coming in from online, so we'll put a few more to you, but one at a time, I think. So the question here about climate change.
Okay.
So how do we achieve order while maintaining human freedom? So this coercing of people, for example, with steps to mitigate climate change, people don't really like this. They're resisting this. They're feeling this... things are getting done sort of globally, circumventing democratic processes. And people feeling that they don't have agency.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you balance this this need to address big global challenges whilst maintaining freedom?
Yeah, well, I think it's a really good question. One of the things I would say is that someone like me, who's mostly working with the kind of core ideas, that I'm not necessarily the best person to answer a question where we need input from people who are dealing more directly with these issues. But I'll say what I can, but it may not be the most satisfactory answer to a very good question like that. I think the first thing I would say is that we're in a situation now where people are feeling pushed into doing things that they wouldn't have wanted to do, partly because we have been deferring the crisis, as Jean-Luc Marion was talking about. We haven't been facing up to our situation, and we're now kind of in this very critical situation. And so this is the justification given by people who are saying, you know, we have to do these things, you know. And other people also fairly are saying, but we didn't agree to this. We're not part of the deliberation process. I'm not sure that I have a very good answer to that. I think I can help to set up a kind of frame using the natural law, help us maybe search together for a better solution. But I think the problem, the key problem there, which I would say is different from the sort of cancel culture thing we were talking about before, is that we seem to be, in terms of the basic structure of reality, in a situation where if we don't really change the way we are relating to the environment fairly quickly, we're going to have really, really serious results. And that, I think, is a much more difficult problem to deal with than the cancel culture one, because of the sort of sense of this being a real problem behind that. We have to deal with the reality of the situation. So I'm not sure that I have the right answer in terms of how to deal with it, but at least we can sort of put the question in a different frame.
Another great question's come in here, which I also would have asked. I was absolutely stunned to hear what you said about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and they didn't manage to get the duties done. I mean, this is absolutely amazing. I don't think most people would know this.
Yeah.
So what would you say? What would have been different had they achieved this balance and the declaration had included rights and duties? And all these years, we've had this emphasis on rights, arguably has led to some of our disturbances now with social peace.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think we would have had a different historical trajectory. I mean, I still think it's better to have the declaration with just the rights in, even it was better to have that than to have nothing. Okay, but it's a bit like the idea of the human person as a pure individual. You know, the rights on their own is a bit like just thinking of ourselves as individuals. There is a sense in which we are individual, we're individuated by our bodies. But we're not only individuals. Our relationships are crucial to who we are, you know. And similarly, the rights issue, if it's not connected with duties, is sort of, it's too narrow, it's too, well, it's not connected to the order issue. That's another way of saying it. Now, one other thing I'd say about that is one of the drafters, who was a Lebanese jurist, René Cassin, he, I think it kind of responds to this problem. He tried to say, well, the rights belong to each other in a kind of a system. And he had this idea of a Greek temple. And the first rights are the basic steps going up to the temple, the basic foundations. And then you have four big columns, which are the four basic groups of rights. The last one is social, cultural, and economic rights. And then you have the apex of the temple, which is holding it all together. And those are the last provisions which deal with setting up systems for protection of human rights. So he did try to sort of say, well, there's a way in which these rights somehow integrate with each other, connected with each other in a systematic way. But you're quite right, it doesn't go as far as saying there are duties, but it was an attempt on his part to try and do something.
Okay, question here from Sister Rose, who's a young Dominican. She says, do you think institutes of religious life have something specific to contribute to the social discussion of peace and negotiating difference through their experience of communal living, the insights of the monastic fathers and mothers?
Yeah, I think it's a very good example of we can have if we have everybody, different voices around the table, the religious can bring into that discussion their experience, which is over, you know, centuries of trying to find good ways of living together. Yeah, so I think on a practical level, it's a very, very useful input. Of course, it's only one particular kind of community, but still it's a real community, and it could have analogues in other kinds of communities, and also we could learn from other communities too. So it's this sharing together, this listening to each other, allowing
sometimes
freedom.
Sometimes difficult to live together.
Yeah, yeah, sometimes difficult to live together. So you've developed ways of trying to do it. The rules and the constitutions mm-hmm. and other things help you, mm-hmm. yeah, get over those problems. Yeah.
Okay, another question, anonymous questioner, is saying, the common good, how can it address the othering of asylum seekers that seems to increase year on year? Especially being an economist, you must have thought a lot about this. And I'd also like to add into that this sort of this tension between understanding of the needs of refugees and asylum seekers and economic migrants, but also balancing the understanding of citizenship, which Catholic social teaching is always trying to balance, isn't it? This understanding of belonging versus also welcoming the other. So anything you'd like to say around that?
Well, I think that's you've phrased it very well there, Jenny, that as we know, Pope Francis especially is so concerned about the problems of migrants and of being welcoming and opening to migrants. At the same time, as you say, communities need to have a sense of belonging to each other, a sense of having a tradition which is handed on, even though traditions, as we know, actually change. That's the whole idea of tradition. It doesn't just stay the same. And migrants coming into it can make an interesting contribution. So I think, again, it's the sort of thing, it's a bit like the problem with the sexual orientation and how it gets very divisive very quickly. This discussion gets divisive too quickly, and we don't sit down and listen to different points of view and genuinely try to work out a solution. I mean, one of the things we could say is that perhaps we've either lost or we never really fully had, I don't know, you might have interesting ideas about this, a real deliberative democracy. You know, where we sit down and deliberate together about the crucial problems. And here we have two issues that really need deliberation. They can't be resolved in them. They're definitely on the second level of natural law. That, you know, trying to work at how we deal in the concrete circumstances that we're in now with those kinds of problems. We can only do it really through deliberation.
Great question here about chaos in the world. So we think so much more chaos coming, you know, coming forward. Communism seems to be again gaining favour among some of the young, and indeed some of the activists today would reject Martin Luther King, saying he didn't go far enough. And even among governments are tempted into this technocratic space, aren't they, to achieve a change without going through the democratic process. Mm. So could you say something about how Catholic social teaching doesn't seek to impose, but is an invitational spirit about it? Some people understand Catholic social teaching as wanting to impose an order. Mm. You've talked a lot about order, but I understand it to have an invitational posture.
Yeah.
And not as against the integralist idea.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear
because it's a crucial thing in the idea of natural law that there's freedom. It's not the kind of freedom from idea which became the dominant idea in that we've inherited from the Enlightenment. You know, give me the maximum space to make as many decisions as I want. And you experience law in that sense as a sort of break on your freedom, something that constrains you, you know. The freedom in the natural law tradition is much more about being able to develop the kind of person you could become, mm-hmm. you know, to become the like virtuoso or the great musician or the great linguist or something. It's that kind of freedom which is much more central to the natural law thinking. So, so the problems that you're talking about, kind of extremism amongst activists and the interest in communism or the technocracy, in a way, they are, again, kind of extreme or maybe not adequate responses to the problem because they're not based enough on the basic structure of reality that we're talking about, which the Pope is trying to get at there. And in a way, they're kind of simple solutions, especially the technocratic one. Look, just let us resolve it, you know? And they don't want to do all the difficult, messy, hard work that is necessary to have that deliberation, to have that sharing, you know?
Another question on climate change from Sarah P. On the question of climate change, presumably an economist like yourself would say we need to value resources like the Amazon properly as systems, and you start by persuading people of the need to protect natural resources like water and soil and so on, instead of starting with abstract ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So your question of order would also allow the substructures of orders of ecosystems, she says.
Yeah, well, again, I mean, here you would be saying that there's a sense of balance, perhaps that's another word we could use. There's a system, you know, we talk about ecosystems, I mean, that the whole thing is working together. And so our economic system, which is our kind of, if you like, created by us, it's not natural in the sense that the nature out there is natural. It's our creation, it's our poesis, if you like, or our praxis. That system needs to respect those resources, the nature of the world around us. Now, that will mean that we need to, for instance, give value to things that we just discounted before. You know, we didn't include those things before in the evaluation. So there's a big thing now about how do you give value to natural things, natural capital, and all this stuff. So there's all different ways now, people trying to find ways of doing it. We haven't, I don't think, got the big breakthrough yet. We'll probably get a few Nobel Prizes in the next few years, people trying to work on it, you know.
I'd love to get onto a couple more quick questions before we have to end. So some people unfamiliar with Catholic social teaching, or indeed Christian social theology, would say, why on earth is the church getting into this kind of space? Shouldn't it just stick with evangelism? Wouldn't more evangelism solve all these problems? We bring people into relationship with Jesus and everything gets solved. So what would you say to that? Because, I mean, this is your life. You're immersed in these questions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I haven't really talked a lot about the spiritual and religious side. We did have some statements in there. And so this talk is sort of focused on the question about social peace, and I tried to use resources that are more open to wider discussion. So although they're religiously influenced, they're also philosophically kind of founded. But I think that one of the crucial things we have to accept today in the world that we're in, that as human beings, as Christians, we are part of a system where we can change what is happening. So whereas for most of Christian history, you know, probably the first 1750 years or so at least of it, the main thing we had to do was to preach the gospel and help people deal with the sufferings and injustices of life and try to live their best they could in the face of all those things with the help of grace. Now we have this whole other dimension, because we're not only, people do have to deal with injustices and sufferings, but we can also change systems. We realize that. So the impact of the gospel needs to come into that as well. And that was the thing that really impacted Ayaan Hirsi Ali, how much Christianity has changed the world that we're in. It's changed the systems that we think differently, we behave differently because of the impact of it. So we can do more on this. We can make the world more like the kingdom of God through working on economic structures, political structures, and so on.
One last question.
Okay.
Joe asks, can you reflect a little on respecting order in relation to the experience of the descendants of chattel enslaved African ancestors, hemmed in by the order of racialized slave systems for centuries, and who now live in a racialized world where they are hemmed in by the West's economic power?
Yeah, so here we have a good example of the sins of the fathers, if you like, which we could say in some way we're part of. Pope John Paul talks about the structures of sin, you know, which we participate in, and we often don't like what we do, but we don't know how to change them. You know, they're bigger than we are. And that's where we need to also talk about grace and prayer, and it's not just human action on that level. So it's interesting that you bring that point up, because when Parchment Terrace was written, one of the big issues that the church and the world was dealing with was decolonization. And he talks about it. I didn't show those, use those bits in the talk, but they are a very important part of this, his thinking. And that when he's talking about disunity and he's thinking about this lack of respect for people just because of the color of their skin and that kind of thing. Now, how we deal with reparation or this, you know, this is another really important, really crucial thing that we're only going to be able to deal with properly with proper deliberation, because there's lots of different factors. The people who are alive today didn't have slaves, but they're benefiting, you know, we know all this stuff. So we need to bring these different points together and talk in a serious way about it.
So many more questions love to ask you. I mean, actually, going back to your deferring of the crisis that can no longer be deferred.
Yeah.
The church really has a special vocation at this moment, doesn't it, around enabling deliberation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You just want to say a couple of things about that before we end with the finish
well,
the question.
Well, yeah. Section. I mean, maybe I'll say one thing that probably nobody knows about, so it's interesting for everybody. In 1958, the Nobel Peace Prize was won by a Dominican friar, the only time a Dominican's won it. And Dominique Pierre, his name was. And he won it for the spirit with which he worked with the displaced people. You know, there were millions of displaced people in Europe after the end of the Second World War. And his core idea in his work was this idea of fraternal dialogue. And if you read his writings, you can see how permeated they are by his religious formation, his Christian faith, you know. I mean, he's got a wonderful a paragraph at one point in his writings where he says, to dialogue means to put yourself between parentheses and really listen to the other person, the goodness, the desire, the real quality of the other person, even though you disagree with them. Even though you disagree with them, you know, you have to keep your own point of view, but you open yourself to listen to the others. And of course, he's trying to build peace amongst often refugee groups that were moving into different countries that weren't necessarily liked that well. And the first thing he says, he's got these three stages of fraternal dialogue. The first thing is start to do something together. And he said, you know, start to do something that deals with the suffering that you're all facing, you know. That's a wonderful way to bring people together, to deal with their common shared suffering, something they share. And then you start to see, he said, you start to see these other people, argue, you start to share with them, you start to build a relationship, you know. Then the dialogue goes on from there. There's also some very good points about truth, but we won't get into that now.
We have to end there.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Let's go over to Simon again.
Thanks very much. So some final thank yous from me. First of all, to you, Sister Helen, not only for your fascinating and very insightful presentation, but also for the dynamic way in which you've engaged with our questions. Thank you so much. And then I'd also like to thank Jenny and the Together for the Common Goods group. It's been a really fruitful engagement for us at Lincoln to be able to work on this lecture series with you, and we're enormously grateful and look forward to taking forward what we've gained from these lectures in terms of our civic engagement here in Lincoln and also in the county. And then finally, I'd also like to thank CCLA for supporting this series. CCLA is the UK's leading sustainability fund manager for charities, faith and public sector organisations, with a long history of managing assets for Christian organisations, and we really appreciate your support.
Thank you, Simon. So we've got to bring this to a close. It's been fantastic. I wish it could have gone on longer. And
thank
I really
you,
think that ending with this theme of deliberation is really about building the common good. I mean, this is, it's fundamentally about relationship, because we are relational beings. And in this, particularly the last 40 years, immersed in a culture of individualism, we've really lost our way. And I think what you've shown us tonight is an incredibly sophisticated way of understanding this. So I'm so grateful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all of you.
So just to say, the recording and the text from tonight, we will make available online with all the others, and do share it, get other people involved. Looking back over this series, we're so grateful to all the speakers that have taken part, that have helped us discern the common good approach to these cultural confusions that we're facing at this critical moment. We're really interested in your feedback, so please do get in touch with us and send us ideas for what we might do next year. Just get in touch with me via our website. And do subscribe to our newsletter to stay updated. Do support our work if you can, and listen to our podcast, Leaving Egypt. There's lots of resources on our website, togetherforthecommongood.co.uk. So thank you, everyone, again, everyone online. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for your fantastic questions. And thank you to everyone in the room. And thank you, Dean Simon. Thank you for the partnership. We have really enjoyed working with you. So all remains to say is good night and God bless.